When you speak of mental health and criminal justice, the vision of most Americans is of a defendant pleading the insanity defense in court. However, it is much more than that. Fact is, over 40% of persons incarcerated have been diagnosed with a mental disorder. Greetings again, I'm Adam Morgan. In addition to having a mental condition prior to entering the criminal justice system, being incarcerated can add to their condition depression, anxiety, substance use, and psychotic disorders, all contributing to the mental health deterioration of prisoners. In Colorado, our judicial branch has a mental health court that crafts effective solutions to the issues faced by defendants with substance use and mental illness. And this is just one option. Through the state civil and forensic mental health system, the challenges posed by prisoners with mental health conditions is undertaken. Over 1,800 state employees are engaged with the work. They are led by the director of the Office of Behavioral Health, Ms. Leora Joseph.
People see health care or mental health care as totally disconnected from criminal justice. And one of the goals of this new office that the governor has kind of set up is exactly to bridge the gap, because in fact, there are so many connections and important nexuses between the two systems. And I'll give you an example. You mentioned the not guilty by reason of insanity, and clearly that is an area that many people are aware of.
Right.
High profile cases. But most cases in our Colorado criminal justice system are actually not those kinds of cases. Most cases involve a legal concept called competency. And I want to explain what that is. Under the Constitution, not only, this is the United States Constitution, not only when you're arrested do you have right to a lawyer. Everybody knows that from watching television and watching Law and Order. But also, you have the right to be able to participate in your defense. And the concept that the law calls that ability is to be competent to stand trial, to understand the charges against you, and confer with your lawyer. So you can't just get a lawyer appointed to you. You have to be able to have meaningful conversations with that lawyer. Now, if you have severe mental illness, you cannot participate in your trial. You can't understand the charges against you. And because liberty is at stake, everything pauses. So if someone is found to be incompetent to stand trial, the entire system comes crushing to a stop.
Really?
The whole court case cannot go on. So I want you to think about, if God forbid you were a victim of a case and everything goes to stop, because the person charged with the crime can't participate in his or her own trial. So that is the essence of the competency issue. And it is such a fundamental, important right. It's embedded in our Constitution. Now, one of the pieces that we've learned about when we talk about competency in the criminal justice system here in Colorado is that about two-thirds of the people in jail who are incompetent, so they've been found to be incompetent, are actually charged with very, very low-level misdemeanors or low-level felonies.
Yeah.
So most of the cases, in fact, aren't the most serious cases that you were referencing earlier, you know, what you called the insanity plea. That is not the bulk of the competency cases that interact with the criminal justice system. They are mostly different kinds of cases.
I guess my question, following up on what you just said, when is that determination made? Is it made when the defendant gets a lawyer and the lawyer can figure out well enough if he's sitting there, if he's competent enough to go through it? Does it? Does the judge do it the first time he comes in and enter a plea? When does that happen?
It's a great question, and it's already like you're catching on how quickly this is an issue. The reality is that competency can be raised at any point in a proceeding. under the law, because it's such an important fundamental right, so it can be raised at any time. Now, realistically, it usually is raised when in the beginning of a case, when someone is newly arrested. And anybody can raise competency. The prosecutor can raise it, the judge can raise it, but you're correct. It's usually an attorney that raises. Yes, you are correct that that's a fundamental part of the right, is that you need to be competent, and that can happen at any, the issue of being incompetent can be raised at any point.
Now, you also said that in Colorado's criminal justice system, the majority of people that are incarcerated there, they have some form of mental issues there. So, yeah.
Let me explain what I'm not talking about the majority of all people incarcerated.
Okay.
I'm talking very, very specifically and intentionally about the people who are deemed incompetent.
Ah, okay.
So when I was talking about the people who are struggling with severe mental illness and don't understand their charges, I'm specifically referring to those people who are incompetent to proceed. They don't understand their charges. And of that, right now in Colorado, we have a little under 400 people in jail with that mental illness that is so severe that they are not able to participate in their trial. And of that 400, two-thirds, and please don't ask me to do the math, of that group are charged with low-level felonies or misdemeanors.
That's interesting that it's low-level felonies or misdemeanors, because many times, being the general public here, which I am too, you think that the criminal behavior that may be charged with, you know, it's more of the violent nature.
Sadly, the question always is, what are the cases that people talk about and what makes the media? And sometimes those are different than what is really happening on the ground. And what I can say is just the reality is that most people with mental illness are not committing serious crimes. I think that's a really important point to know.
Yeah. I'm struggling for a word right now. I want to say while they are incarcerated, do they receive treatment? But do you call it incarcerated while they're receiving treatment so they can become competent to understand their trial? Do they receive treatment there? And is that treatment to get them healthy so they can have that trial, or is it just to keep them stabilized?
That's great. Oh, my God. So many questions, and they're great. So treatment to become, what the word, the technical word is restored to competency. Treatment is done in the state hospital because it's medical treatment. It, you know, mental health is health. And so you need medical treatment, and it needs to be in clinical settings. It can also be, at, depending on if the judge allows the person out of jail, it can also be done in community, at a community mental health center. So treatment is clinical.
Right.
And the purpose of treatment under the statute is so that they can be restored to competency and then be able to participate in their trial. So the goal of competency and restoration treatment is to come back and participate in the trial. It is not a full service, all holistic mental health care. It's about psychiatric stabilization.
Yeah.
And the ability to participate in your trial.
Now, you mentioned that the judge in some instances can allow the person back into the community while they are receiving treatment. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes. So a judge makes the decision.
Yeah.
About who stays in jail or not. And so if you're found incompetent, a judge still can make the decision that you can be out on bond, just like in any other case. And if you're out on bond, you receive treatment in the community. And you can get your psychiatric stabilization and your restoration treatment in the community. And in fact, Colorado has the largest outpatient meaning out of jail, restoration program in the country.
If we have the largest outpatient program in the country, then I guess the one thing the public needs to know, those people that are the outpatients are not prone to violence or anything else while they're being treated to eventually stand trial then.
Well, a judge makes the decision about who stays in jail or who goes out.
Mm-hmm. Is there a specific, I don't know if you survey any of the people, any of those that are incarcerated, but is there a certain mental state that keeps coming back as being one of those that ends up being a driver which leads them to commit the felony in the first place?
Yeah. So I'm not a clinician. I'm a lawyer.
Right.
But we have a lot of people with, you know, there's a class of mental illnesses that are considered severe mental illness. So severe schizophrenia, schizoactive disorder, severe, those kinds of very serious mental illness that are the ones that are being treated in this hospital situation.
And that also includes people with substance abuse then, or is that just an entirely different classification and their mental illness?
That is such a good question. So your question is highlighting one of the very complicated issues. Substance use disorder is a very serious situation. It is not the same as severe mental illness.
Okay.
So someone who has substance use disorder obviously needs treatment. They don't necessarily need a psychiatric hospital. What we are seeing, though, is a strong interplay between severe mental illness and substance use disorder. And we are estimating at this point that over 50%, closer to probably 70% of the people who are now getting arrested have some interplay of those two things. And it's really important to separate it out because different disorders need different kinds of treatment, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
and it's not helpful to lump everybody together.
Now, do you go through the same type of assessments when it comes to juveniles as well, as to what degree of mental illness they may or may not have? And if they are juvenile, then wouldn't they have a caretaker is probably the wrong word, but wouldn't they have a legal guardian or somebody who would have to help them understand their trial in the first place?
Well, the juvenile system, we consider it it's a whole different system, partially because the criminal legal system also talks about juvenile adjudication in a totally different way. So the juvenile system, it has its own whole system and its own competency system. And right now in Colorado, while there are serious mental health needs for many of our juveniles, the issue of severe mental illness and the juvenile criminal issue is not the much of the focal point right now.
Yeah.
And make sure, I want to be very intentional. Our juveniles need all the support we can give them. And that includes mental health treatment and counseling. But the instance of severe, severe mental illness, like I'm talking about in this call, is not as much of an issue with our juvenile population right now.
I know you probably sit at your desk and you see all the news stories and everybody saying, you know, we have to do more in the mental health area to support our youth. And what's it going to be and where are we going to go? And you're sitting there saying, we're already there.
What your system has done
probably needs to be extended to those in high school, at least the symptoms there are, so they can be taken care of before that youth commits a crime.
100%. Please don't hear me say we don't need to do anything more. There needs to be full attention paid to our youth in every spectrum, making sure there's equity across the state in terms of their educational opportunities, their opportunities to access treatment before they get involved in the criminal justice system. To me, that is the most important part. Do our youth have ability to get help before things progress in a negative way?
Our focus on this edition is mental health and the criminal justice system with the supervisor of Colorado's Office of Behavioral Health, Ms. Leora Joseph. We will continue our conversation with her on our next edition. I'm Adam Morgan. Do stay in touch, and many thanks to you as well for sharing a few moments of your weekend with us.
Relationship violence is not okay. It is okay, though, to ask for help. Our Colorado community values health, well-being, and will not tolerate relationship violence in any form. Such are the headline and opening words at the StandUpColorado.org website, the movement to end relationship violence. Greetings again. I'm Adam Morgan. 1 in 7 people in Colorado have experienced relationship violence in some form. Also known as domestic violence, relationship violence is behavior used to intimidate, threaten, to maintain power and control over another. The Colorado Coalition Against Domestic Violence are the architects of the Stand Up Colorado campaign to not just bring awareness to the issue, but to end the behavior altogether. Leading the coalition is Executive Director Ms. Amy Miller.
There's some kind of risk involved, right?
Yeah.
So people who are in an abusive relationship are dealing with those and making decisions based about those daily risks, and they're dealing with the risks that they know already from the person that's been abusing them. So it's counterintuitive, but sometimes it's actually safer to stay in a relationship until you can get some things lined up and get the courage to leave, because you're living in an atmosphere of threats and intimidation and coercion, and you might have been physically abused already, and with threats that'll happen again if you try to leave, or, you know, if you don't do things a certain way or whatever. It's almost like, I think it's helpful for people to know that it's way beyond physical abuse, right?
Right.
And sometimes there's not even ever any physical abuse that happens in these relationships. But to know that there's this atmosphere that's always there of intimidation, of threats, of fear, that's real and it's intense. It's almost like being a hostage in your relationship, which wasn't like that in the first place, right? It was, you start dating somebody, you go on in the relationship because things are good, and it's insidious. The abuse and the control creeps in over time. And then even in that atmosphere, you still have good times with that person. And what a lot of people want, they really want that person to change their behavior.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily want to end a relationship or break up a family.
That's
they want
for sure.
That person to change their behavior.
Now,
and in some cultures, right?
Yeah.
That's really taboo, you know, or it goes against the religion, or
that's true. It
there's
does.
All these things that are being balanced by that person, those daily risks and those risks from that person that's being abusive. So those decisions get really much more complicated than most of the rest of us ever have to make.
You mentioned earlier that sometimes with respect to relationship abuse and the signs, those kinds of things go on, that you've seen them as early as 10 and 11 years old. When we are, I guess we all are, you know, not all of us, those who are not married, in meeting people and trying to evaluate them as people and human beings, many times they give us indicators, but because this is a new and exciting relationship, we overlook them. And then next thing you know, they're in this abusive relationship that they shouldn't have been, simply because we either romanticized it and overlooked it, and then bingo, you're done, you're stuck. So do we need to do a better job of looking at the whole person? And I know you're not a psychologist, but the whole person and the indicators that they're giving us. And that would probably help to make sure that ladies, especially ladies, don't end up in that kind of relationship in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of it is educating people about what relationship violence really looks like.
Yeah.
Most people are pretty limited in their knowledge of how this plays out on a day-to-day basis. Most people are really focused on, oh, well, you know, if somebody's hitting their intimate partner, right? Or otherwise physically abusing their intimate partner. But there's so much more to it than that.
Is it that we don't want to deal with it? Because if Amy is wonderful and she may be beating on me yesterday, but I love that part, and I'll just forget about the bad part and just stick with the good part, and we overlook it, and then we go further and further in, and then, you know, we're in trouble.
That's certainly part of the dynamic, and yeah, we all do that.
Yeah.
Whether our relationships are healthy or not, right?
Yeah.
We all, you fall in love with somebody, and in that process, you are focused on what's good about that person. I'm sure every single one of us, any of us who've ever fallen in love with somebody, have found ourselves defending that person against any tiny little criticism that's an outsider yeah. might make, right? And part of that is minimizing what that person did or justifying what that person did because you love that person.
Yeah.
And you don't want to see their flaws. You know, and we all have them,
yes,
right? And we all do this.
Put the makeup on my flaws right now.
Right?
Yeah.
So this same thing happens in relationships that turn slowly abusive and controlling over time. And like I mentioned a minute ago, those bad times aren't ever present. There are good times, too, where that person remembers why they fell in love with that person in
yeah,
the first place.
True.
And that person that's being abusive continues to promise that that'll never happen again. And I swear I'm going to change my behavior, right?
Yeah.
And they can. That behavior change is absolutely possible. But it takes, you know, a commitment. It takes acknowledging you have a problem.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like an alcoholic, you have to acknowledge it. And a lot of guys, and I'm going to pick on guys because I'm one, guys don't want to do that. You know,
that's right. Because
they say, well, it's okay. I won't do it again. I can handle it.
Right. Or it can be viewed as a sign of weakness to acknowledge that, you know, you have flaws. Though, really, we all do. We're all human. Right.
Sure.
None of us are perfect. But I think that plays into some of the issues around masculinity and how that's defined in our culture. Right.
Yeah.
And feeling like you can acknowledge mm-hmm. that you've got a behavior problem that you need to work on, right? And to actually seek help
yeah.
from somebody. And there's stigma associated with all of that, right?
Stigma that you're a weak guy. If
that
you
you're
have
a weak
to,
guy or that
if you have
you're
to
mentally
admit
ill.
She said something and did something and you don't have control of it,
right?
Something's wrong with you, man.
Right? Although, yeah. like, this is not a mental health problem. It's a social problem.
Yeah.
It's rooted
well, some
in
of it's
gender
mental because
inequities.
They internalize this is who I am.
Right.
And it's up there in the head first, and I have to demonstrate.
Right.
That I'm like the other guys.
Right. You're exactly right. And there's a lot of pressure on men, unfortunately, to stay contained in this pretty small little box
mm-hmm.
Of how masculinity is defined and what's acceptable. And where you really have strength is actually in acknowledging that I have an issue and I need help.
Okay.
I mean, that takes strength.
Oh, yeah, it does. It does. Are we finding the same thing or is your organization finding the same thing among LGBTQ communities to abusive relationships do happen? I guess they could because a relationship is a relationship. It doesn't matter what the orientation is. It's who's trying to control who about what.
That's exactly right. So relationship violence can happen to anyone, and it does happen to people from all backgrounds, including people who identify as LGBT or Q. And so the dynamics might look a little bit different
sure.
in how that abuse is and power and control is playing out in that relationship. This is an issue that really doesn't discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
It affects and can affect any of us,
sure.
Frankly. So you might have somebody who, you know, is threatening to out their partner to their boss or their coworkers when that person hasn't
control again.
Right. And so that's something you can hold over somebody's head to actually, you know, make them behave in certain ways,
sure.
get your needs met, do what you want them to do, or keep them from leaving
mm-hmm.
that relationship.
Okay, grab one. I guess the other thing that really, after a few months of seeing your campaign on the air, Stand Up Colorado, what is the goal? What would you like to see when the first phase is completed? It's probably going to be several phases along the way, but what are the change are you looking for? Are you looking for change in the abuser, the abuse, or people to who may know of such to also stand up and tell those other folks, stop it, you know, go get some help?
So over the course of the campaign, which we hope to run for at least 10 years.
Yeah.
Because if not longer, because we want to affect an entire generation of Coloradans.
Okay.
And to get the ultimate change that we want to see, which is really two things. One, that the community understands that this is their problem.
Uh-huh.
It's everyone's problem. And that through the deeper education they're getting on what relationship violence is, they're able to recognize it. And then we also educate them about how to respond. So we're going to call these folks upstanders, right? We want them to stand up and take an active role in addressing this issue, whether it's at the individual level with somebody that they know who is abusing their partner and or their family, or somebody they know who's being abused, or just because, you know, in their history they had that experience, they know somebody that's had that experience, right?
Yeah.
And because it flows over into every sphere of society, it really affects all of us in ways that people don't really even understand. So that's one of the things we want to accomplish.
Uh-huh. And what's the other one?
We also want people who are using abusive behaviors to realize that that is what they're doing, and to realize that there's help out there and that they can change their behavior, that they don't have to continue on with this existence where in reality they're only getting their needs met in that relationship. And that relationship's probably going to end at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to know what real love is, to be in a genuine, healthy relationship that is based on equality and respect, where there's give and take, right?
Yeah.
If that's something that they want for themselves, if they want their children to grow up healthy and to go on to have good relationships in every sphere of their life, not even just intimate partners, right?
Yeah.
Then they can seek change for their own behavior.
Yeah,
they can seek that help out. So we want that to happen. And actually, there's one other thing that we want to accomplish.
Sure.
We intend through this campaign to shift radically the social norm in our state around the acceptance of relationship violence as something that's inevitable, that we have to deal with in our communities, that we have to deal with in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods.
Is
and
that,
it's not is inevitable.
Is that our norm? Really?
That is our norm. There are people that don't tolerate it.
Yeah.
But most people do. And you know that because of the lack of action that people take on this issue. So phase one is what we're in right now. There are three phases of this campaign. Phase one is doing that deep dive into all the different aspects, all the forms of relationship violence, because for people to be able to intervene or even recognize it in their own relationship or their own behavior, they have to know what it looks like.
Yeah.
And it's not, like I said, just physical violence, right?
Sure.
It's emotional, it's economic, it's psychological, it's sexual, it's all of those things.
Sure.
And then phase two, we get into really messaging to people who are using abuse behaviors that there is hope, that they can have relationships based on love and respect and mutuality and not be hurting their loved ones any longer.
Okay.
And actually getting people to reach out voluntarily for help.
There you are a person resorting to domestic violence, a person being the target of such behavior, or perhaps you're just seeking to assist someone caught in the relationship violence cycle. The Stand Up Colorado Helpline is available to assist. Their number is 855-978-2638. That's 855-9-STAND-UP. Our appreciation to Amy Miller, the Executive Director of the Colorado Coalition Against Domestic Violence, for continuing as our guest again on this edition. I'm Adam Morgan. Do keep in touch. Stay on your game. And we thank you for sharing a few moments of your weekend with us.